There are obviously there are many good examples of group behaviour which are found in nature, and we've already heard about some of them. Obviously, the honeybee is an extraordinary example of group behaviour, and people have said, you know, if all the honeybees die out, which sometimes has been a threat that they might because of disease and parasites, then that would be the end of the human race, because we so depend on honeybees for pollination. But anyway, I mean, clearly, very important part of group behaviour. Another famous example is this: what the male emperor penguins do during the Antarctic winter. The female leaves the egg with the male. The males huddle, and they so arrange things. It's rather like Jeff Albert's example of the rat pups. They so arrange things so that when they're on the outside, they kind of take the full brunt of the Antarctic winter, and then they move into the middle to get some benefit from being surrounded by other penguins. Obvious example of lovely group behaviour. Now, they're bad arguments, and Ellen has already mentioned them. I mean, if, as Wynne Edwards argued, a population is outstripping its resources, and then Wynne Edwards argued, all reproductive individuals should stop breeding for the good of the group. And of course, the reason why that is a bad argument is because individuals who breed while others are not doing that will eventually leave descendants that replace all those who failed to breed. So the argument was it was subverted by those who didn't go along with the rest. And I mean, the general point is that cooperation is vulnerable to cheating or freeloading, and that for that reason it'll tend not to be stable. But there are some interesting exceptions, which I'll come on to in a moment. Now, in terms of what I want to talk about, I want to talk about where aged individuals are relations, and there's a very, very extensive literature on this, and where cooperating individuals both benefit, but they benefit separately. And then I want to come on to groups containing cooperative individuals are successful, but individuals benefit separately, a rather more subtle case. And then to the thing which really kind of lies at the heart of, you know, the thing that Vidya presented with it in terms of a sort of challenge. Can cooperative behavior be an emergent property of group living? So that's what I'll try and cover in my talk. First of all, some definitions. You have two individuals, and an individual's behavior is selfish if it improves its fitness at the expense of another individual. So the plus means fitness increases, minus means fitness goes down. Altruism is the opposite, where there's a cost to the altruist of doing something, so it loses fitness as a result of doing what it does, and there's an improvement in the fitness of the beneficiary of the altruistic act. Mutualism is a case where both individuals benefit as a result of the cooperative behaviour. And then there's a special case of mutualism, which is called reciprocal altruism, where one individual does something which loses its fitness, the other one benefits, but then there's a payback. It's rather like I pay for beer tonight and you pay for beer tomorrow. At a later occasion, the other individual that has benefited initially then, as a cost to itself, returns the favour. And so that's called reciprocal altruism.
Can I just ask at this point, what do you mean by fitness precisely when you put those plus and minus signs?
Well, strictly speaking, whether or not you leave offspring behind or leave descendants.
That's probably
the simplest explanation. The more complicated explanation, that's the easiest one.
No, but this is what you mean.
This is what I mean, yes. So, first of all, taking the general issue where giving benefits altruistically to related individuals and what that leads to in terms of evolution. And this, it goes back perhaps to Haldane, but Bill Hamilton produced this rule, which is very widely used now, which is that self-sacrificial behaviour will tend to evolve when C is less than R times B, where C is the fitness cost to the actor, R is the genetic relatedness between the actor and the recipient, And B is the fitness benefit to the recipient. So he said that under those circumstances, you tend to see self-sacrificial behavior evolving. It's worth noting that this is very much a population genetics model, and it was based very much on there being a simple relationship between genes and behavior. And I'll come back to that, because it is actually rather crucial to understanding some of the controversies that have happened since. Anyway, under those conditions, the honeybee benefits, the queen benefits by the behavior of the sterile workers. And the sterile workers do that because they're very closely related to the queen. Is the coefficient of relatedness? Oh, yes. Yes, I meant from 0 to 1. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And that's crucial, actually, in some of the discussions we'll come to later on. So, anyway, let's come on to symbiosis and mutualism and reciprocal altruism, all cases where both parties benefit. Ellen mentioned the other day, I gather that Lynn Margulis was preceded by Russians, but she's made the idea famous that the mitochondria, which pack each cell, that's the powerhouses of each cell, they have their own genes which are replicated separately from the nuclear genes. And clearly, in this case, if the argument is correct, the mitochondria, which derived from an independent organism originally, now benefit from being in the cells of a much larger organism, and a much larger organism benefits from having the mitochondria. So it's, in a way, it's a good example of mutualism. Another one, a quite different type of thing, is, and this is a very beautiful example in a way, you sometimes see in the sea a great big predator fish, and swimming in front of it is a little striped fish. And the striped fish makes quite a sort of dance in front of the predator fish. And then the predator, instead of eating the little striped fish, opens its mouth, and the little cleaner fish goes in and takes food out of the teeth of the big predator fish. And after a while, if the predator wants to get on with other things, the fish then clicks its jaw, and the cleaner fish get out. But both parties are benefiting. The cleaner fish are getting food, and the predator fish is having its teeth clean, getting the bacteria and debris removed from his teeth. So both parties benefit. It's an example of mutualism. Another example, which I mentioned very briefly at the beginning, is reciprocal altruism. And here are two baboons fighting. B happens to be have a close relationship with A. And what A does when he sees B in a fight, he intervenes to help B. And so A helps B at some cost to itself. I mean, A may get hurt in the process. But this is an example where, as a result of the action, B benefits possibly at the cost to A. But that's then reciprocated, so that later on, when A is in a fight, B will intervene and help A. So that the whole system depends on the reciprocal nature of the cooperation. So, it's another special case of mutualism. And both parties are benefiting, but they're both benefiting separately. Another interesting case is what happens when you get cooperation in parental care. As everybody knows, you get a whole variety of different types of parental care. And I mean, if you take the case of pelagic fish like the herring, neither party cares for the young. They release their gametes into the water, fertilization takes place in the water, and there's no parental care. In most mammals, only the female cares for the young. And there are some mammals where male does so as well, but in most cases, it's the female who cares for the young. There are several cases where the male cares for the young, that the famous stickleback is one of them. And the phalarope, the redneck phalarope, is another beautiful example where the beautifully coloured one, or the more beautifully coloured one, which is the one that's underneath in the mating, she leaves her partner after mating, and it's the male who looks after the offspring, who incubates the young and feeds the offspring. And then, of course, there are many examples in birds where both parents look after the young. And this is a case of an Arctic swan, where the young stay with their parents all the way through their first winter, and the parents protect the young. It's very much, and the parents actually tend to stay mated for as long as they both live. A case of very powerful biparental care. And the issue here is this an example of group selection, or can it be explained more simply? Well, the argument, I think, fairly conclusively, is that biparental care benefits each individual separately. John Maynard Smith, who many of you will know, who produced a very beautiful model for this to explain all types of parental care. And he published that in Animal Behavior some time ago. And what the model consists of is this, that you've got male and female, and that both male and female have two options. They can care for the offspring, or they can desert and leave it all the care to the other party. So there's all those possibilities. And we can look at what the female gets and what the male gets out of all of these combinations. So if you take the case where both parties care for the young, you get P2, which is the probability that young will survive with two parents caring. P1 is the case where one party deserts and the other party cares. So the probability is that the young will survive with one parent caring. And then there's a number of other possibilities where you look at the probability that the male will acquire another mate so that it can increase its own fitness, having deserted the first mate. And there are many examples of that, and also in the birds, as you'll see. And the alternative is the female deserts, leaving the male, as in the case of the phalarope, to look after the young. And finally, there are cases where both parties desert, and the question is, what is the probability that the young will survive with neither parent caring? So, probably 0 to 1. We could discuss it. It's probably difficult enough to understand this anyway. But we can discuss that in a moment. The point is that when you've got all these possibilities, which one of them will evolve will depend for the benefit to one party and the benefit to the other. So that if it's the case that both parties benefit most by caring for the young, both of them caring for the young, then they will do so. But if one of them deserts, it may do better by finding another mate and obtaining more offspring that way. So the model very nicely explains all kinds of variety of parental care that we have, and explains it in terms of the likely probabilities. Now, there's a very interesting case of the European bird, the dunnock. And normally, both parents share in the care of the young. But some years ago, Nick Davis noticed that a female who was already mated with one male would then, while that male wasn't looking, go and mate with another male. So, and if she did it well, she ended up with two males looking after her young. There were a number of possible combinations, but anyway, the most interesting one was where you have one female who's got two males looking after you. It could go wrong. I mean, if one male discovers that it's been cuckooed in a way, he may then desert. But if she does it well, both males end up looking after after her young. And she does too. But the point is that if you look at the amount of care that the female gives and the amount of care the male gives, that there's a clear relationship. And so the more male help that she gets, the less she has to give. And so she can obviously benefit from this, because there's a cost, obviously, to giving care. You have to look for food for your offspring. So this kind of relationship. Also, the male will respond to how much the female is giving. So the male's reaction will be the obverse of that, that the more care that the female is providing, the less he has to provide. And so in an interesting theoretical paper, Houston and Davis argued that both parties benefit from what they do, and you end up with an equilibrium, which is what you often see in births, with both parents caring. But if one party disappears for one reason or another, gets killed by a predator, then the other party will have to devote a lot more time to caring for the young. So, I mean, these are all cases where the individual is separately benefiting from what looks like good cooperative behaviour. Now, there are mechanisms for securing cooperation. Part of this generates from a famous quote from Machiavelli in The Prince, and he says, "It's much safer to be feared than loved. Fear preserves you by dread of punishment, which never fails." Very cynical comment, but that's always Machiavelli. He's just being very pragmatic about how you can get people to obey you. You make them fear you rather than make them love you. Then Clutton-Brock and Parker suggested that this role may be important in animal societies, and that individuals that are not cooperating can be punished. And there are now a number of studies, particularly there's a nice piece of work by Clutton-Brock and his group on the meerkat, where the individuals do spend a lot of time watching out for predators. And they take turns in doing this, it's very important for the survival of them all that they watch out for predators. Now, sometimes there are individuals who don't do this, who don't take their turn. And what Clutton-Brock and his group found was that the individuals that didn't cooperate were punished. They were beaten up by the others until they didn't play their role in looking out for predators. So it looks as though some of this is ensuring cooperation by, as Machiavelli says, fear of punishment, which never fails, he says. In our own society, it seems that we do have unconscious and maybe conscious mechanisms by which we sense the disapproval of others. And one of them is if you're being looked at, you'll tend to be more cooperative if you sense that you're being watched. I mean, there's been a number of studies, lab studies done on this, and one of them, there's been a more naturalistic study done coincidentally by my daughter and her colleagues. And what my daughter had to do in her lab was every week to collect money from the group for milk that they'd used in their coffee. And so she put up a notice every week saying, "Time to pay your money for your milk." And they would do it on a basis of whether or not they were honest. But each week, the sign saying "time to pay for your milk" was accompanied by either a pair of eyes or by flowers. So week one there were eyes, week two there were flowers, week three there were eyes, and so forth, all the way for 10 weeks. And what she then did, what they did, in their lab, was to see how much money was actually given, and it was very striking. people gave more money, three times as much money on average, if there was eyes there. And when she did a sort of follow-up to see whether people had been aware of this, they said they hadn't been aware. They had no idea that they were being more honest when there were eyes on the sign, which is a very nice example of how social pressure can actually make you behave more cooperatively. So it's in this case, I suppose there's implicit punishment. There's certainly social disapproval if you don't behave honestly. But the people weren't aware that they were responding so strongly to these cues. So, I mean, but here again, I mean, this is not an example of group behavior, it's an example of individuals responding to cues which will benefit them. So, now we come to a whole new literature on what's called the new group selection. There's a lot of people, Kovac is another one, there are several of them now who've been writing, and it's attracted an enormous amount of controversy. I'm not going to go into the details of their models, but in a way it can be expressed quite clearly by Ed Wilson's initial statement of it in his famous book, Sociobiology. And what he said was, you could have different types of selection. You could have selection at the level of the individual. You can have selection because they're all related to each other. I won't go into the migrant selection, but you can get selection for the individuals that migrate. Or, Wilson suggested, you could have a selection between different populations, so that if one population, for whatever reason, is producing more descendants than another population, then that population will benefit relative to the other populations. So, I mean, in a sense, this is much the same sort of argument comes up in later writings about group selection. So, this has generated enormous controversy, and I don't want to go into all the details of it because they're quite complex. But I mean, in essence, the thought is that individuals behaving as groups can benefit the whole group relative to other groups. Now, the so-called new group selection has been criticised. This is the new edition of what used to be Krebs and Davis is now Nicholas Davis, John Krebs, and Stuart West. And they have quite an extensive discussion of all these models. This edition of Behavioral Ecology has just come out, incidentally, for those who want to see it. It's a beautiful book, but I mean, there are things which are quite controversial. And what they say towards the end of the book is that the new group selection approach tells us that cooperation is favoured by increasing group benefits, reducing individual costs, and increasing the proportion of genetic variance that is between group as opposed to within group. However, they say, this is mathematically equivalent to the prediction from Hamilton's rule that outcome is favoured by high B, low C, and high R. High benefits to the others, low cost to the altruists, and a high degree of relatedness.
Can I just ask for a psychoanalysis? In things such as big herds and big flocks of birds and so on, how do you differentiate between the effect of the particular ecology, the environment, and what's happening in the group?
Well, maybe I can come to that in a moment. I think it's an important question. Sorry?
Sorry, just a clarification. Hope for the war. What you call group here does not need to be. Just for clarification, the group here, do the individual need to be genetically related or not?
Well, that's the issue.
That's
absolutely against the core of it. I think I'll come to that in the next slide. This is a kind of. Now, there is a caution that one wants to apply to this argument. And as I said earlier, the Hamilton's rule is essentially a gene-based rule. And it makes the assumption that the genes don't interact, that there's no epistasis, there's not more than one gene involved. And if you do get interaction, as actually seems highly likely in many cases, then the calculation of the coefficient of readiness is effective. So the more possibility there is for recombination between interacting genes, the lower the coefficient of relatedness. So this actually will weaken the strength of the Davis and et al. Critique of the new group selection. That's something one has to bear in mind. I mean, we of course, we don't know the genetic basis of many of these cases, but it doesn't follow that they're necessarily right. And my sense is that, in a way, the critique by the behavioural ecologists is, in a way, developmentally naive. And I'll say more about that. But there's also another point, which this relates to Ellen's talk, and that's the notion of selection. Because if you think about the Darwinian notion of selection, the way it's often presented is that here we have two rabbits, then the kind of hand of selection comes down, and the more conspicuous rabbit, more likely to be seen by predators. And so it's the black one that benefits, and that's the result of this process of selection. But notice, I mean, there is an implicit agent here. The agent is the hand. If you look at the literature on evolutionary biology, there really is a strong tendency to personify natural selection. So, take a few examples. So, natural selection pressurizes. Yeah. Natural selection forces. Natural selection scrutinizes. Natural selection picks out. Natural selection stabilizes. Natural selection sculpts. And there are many others. I mean, so all of these cases, natural selection is treated as an agent. And we may all know what we're talking about when we do this, but I suspect that very often don't, and there's a kind of slippage that can occur in the language. Anyway, I mean another actually rather important point, and that's something which I've been writing about a lot, is that the metaphor of natural selection does also presuppose that the animals involved, or the organisms involved, are essentially passive in the whole process. And in fact, we know that organisms actually play very important roles in the evolution of their descendants. And, I mean, it may be in terms of the control of the environment. There's now extensive literature on niche construction. It may be in terms of choice, where an example of that is where predators' reactions to prey change in the course of evolution, but they actually drive the process. Something which I think actually is very important is where the adaptability of the organism is actually a driver of genetic change. It sort of sometimes comes under the rather misleading title of the Baldwin effect. I think that actually is misleading. But it's essentially the point is that adaptability can lead to changes in behavior, which then in the process of time, the various components of the sequence can be made spontaneous by mutation and Darwinian evolution. And so eventually the genetic change replaces the initial phenotypic change produced by adaptability to generate a highly organized bit of behavior, which initially was not transmitted from one generation to the next, but then becomes transmitted by genetic change. And then finally, an important point, I think, actually, is that mobility itself, which you get not only in animals, but also in plants, when they disperse their seeds, if they land in a place where different degrees of the phenotype are being expressed, this can also be a driver of evolution. So there's an element of the active organism, which is often left out by the notion of natural selection. Anyway, I'm not in any way suggesting that the metaphor is totally wrong. But what I want to say is, and here some of the historians of science have actually made an important point, which was that in the 19th century, when The Origin of Species was published by Darwin, people had all been brought up on William Paley's book called Natural Theology, in which he suggested, of course, Paley suggested, that there was an intelligent creator, and this explained the beautiful adaptations which you see. And so what some historians of science have suggested is that for people who've been brought up on William Paley, it was good to have a metaphor which actually then replaced the godlike intelligent creator with a natural creator. So it became a very easy thing for them to accept that, accept Darwin's ideas. And I would argue now that the metaphor doesn't actually convert anybody. I mean, if you talk to a creationist, they don't listen for a minute to what you're saying. And I think that actually the metaphor can obscure the nature of the illusionary processes, but that I think is an important point. And as I've already argued, I mean, in particular, the metaphor doesn't encourage understanding of the active ways in which organisms can influence the evolution of their descendants. But focusing on Darwin's evolutionary process as opposed to his metaphor, I think that is helpful. So just to make the point, I mean, we've already had some discussion in this workshop about what generates variation in the first place. That's the first step in the Darwinian process. You have to have variation for evolution to take place. So there may be a whole variety of things which generate variation. They may not be in mutation. They might be as already been argued. Maybe due to the physical or chemical constraints on the organism. So that's one important issue. A second important issue is what are the ways in which you get differential survival and reproductive success? Again, a big area of empirical inquiry. And thirdly, and again, very important for us here, are what are both the genetic and the epigenetic, environmental and social factors? I mean, you can get, obviously, transmission from one generation to the next by social learning. What of all these things enable the characteristics of an individual or a group or a lineage to be replicated in subsequent generations? So all these issues are important. They all get down to the nature of the mechanism, and they don't involve a sort of a metaphorical overlay. So, I mean, that all said, I think one has to be quite careful about some of the critiques of the new group ideas and reflect carefully on how we use our concepts. One of the interesting things actually in the Davies et al. Textbook, they say, well, selection can take place at all sorts of different levels, but it's only at the level of the individual that adaptation takes place, or even at the gene level. They say adaptation takes place at the gene level. And my sense is it'll really make sense to claim that adaptation takes place at the level of the gene. Might in some cases, but I think it rarely will be the case. And as we know now, I mean, the whole concept of the gene is itself breaking apart for a whole variety of reasons. There are many different definitions which are given for the gene. And so the emphasis on adaptation at the gene level, I think, probably is not something we should consider too strongly, although I have welcome views about that. And I think a critical point, and actually Eleanor's already made this point, that adaptation doesn't have to occur at the level of the individual. So then this raises the question, which is central to this whole workshop. Can adaptation take place at the level of the groups? And if it can, in the sense that the adaptation is something which groups do, but individuals can't do, then the whole notion of cheating, of free loading and all of that goes out of the window, because, I mean, it's a group activity which can't be subverted by individual action. Well, what evidence do we have for that? I think the evidence is a bit patchy, to be honest, but I mean, if you take these wonderful examples of lichens, which we were seeing yesterday on our walk, very sensitive to pollution, of course, but they are, these lichens, which grow very slowly on rocks and trees, are a product of a mutualistic association between fungi and algae. And the question then is, do they generate properties which are a characteristic of that mutualistic association. So, I mean, we have a fungal phenotype, and we have an algal phenotype, and they combine to produce a lichen phenotype. Now, if it's the case that the lichen phenotype is a result of the emergent characteristics of a fungal phenotype and an algal phenotype, then you have the possibility of adaptations at the level of the lichen, the level of the whole group. And, I mean, clearly it will be the case that differential survival will act at the level of the whole group, because neither the fungi nor the algae can do the job on their own. So, if this is the case, we then have the possibility of two different phenotypes, one produced by an interaction between F1 and A1, the fungal and the algal phenotype, or F2 and A2, those two phenotypes combining to produce the lichen phenotype. Then it may be the case that only one of these survives. And, for example, for reindeer or caribou, as Americans call them, are very dependent on lichens for feeding. If one lichen produces, let's say, a toxin which makes it less likely to be eaten, then that will do better than the ones which don't produce that toxin. So we do really have the possibility here of a higher level selection. Another example, which I mean may or may not be helpful, is here are wolves chasing a deer. One's actually got hold of the deer, but the deer are actually pretty effective at getting away from wolves. And in nature, what you find is that wolves never chase deer for very long. Quite unlike the proponents of hunting that we have in the UK, where hounds are used to chase deer. The wolves usually give up after a maximum of about 1,000 metres. They don't run very far. And the deer can sprint very fast. But, I mean, the interesting thing about wolves is that they have another strategy, which is this, that here's a group of wolves chasing a deer. And he's going off in this direction. But there's another part of the pack which are lying in ambush, waiting for the deer to be driven towards them. And they're much more likely to get the deer when they have ambush. Now, there is also obviously a possibility of freeloading here, but there's also a possibility here that ambushing and driving are a group activity which is not easily subverted by any individual gene. So if that is the case, then you will have an example of a higher level selection taking place, because the combination of chasing and ambushing is itself a group character rather than an individual character.
What group can share in the
food? Oh yes, they share the food, yes.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm not going to go into this, but there's now extensive literature on behavioral economics, and it's been led by a whole lot of very distinguished authors like Herbert Simon and Gary Becker and Daniel Kuhneman, and there are lots of Nobel Prizes to be had here. But the interesting thing to say about this work is that people don't always behave rationally in terms of self-interest. They will behave in ways which actually benefit other members of the human race. I mean, there's much discussion about all of this, but it's worth just mentioning that there's a whole new literature coming out here. There's a nice paper by Fair and Fischbacher on this, and there's much more recent literature going on, showing that there's activity going on which would not be explained terms of the kind of rather crude, rational egoist. Here we have two examples, one from the First World War, one from Stalingrad, of large numbers of people dying for love of their country. I mean, obviously, love of country can be very fatal to the individual. I mean, obviously. And the question then is why do they do it? I mean, this was an issue that worried Darwin and started in a way that the whole debate about group selection. Because we, in particular, seem to be a species in which there's a great deal of activity where the individual really loses out for the whole population. So, what does an individual do? They're faced with a whole variety of choices. They can be selfish. They can fear that they will be caught out if they're being if they're being selfish, like giving a milk to the people who are collecting it in the lab. They can be enlightened self-interest in the sense that they get benefit from being cooperative, or they may decide, or this individual may decide to help the group at the cost of himself. That there are aspects of that choice which an individual has, and you may choose not to help your group, but many people do, of course, choose to help their group. So, I mean, in conclusion. Well, no, I mean, obviously, in war, you could get people just being frightened of being punished for not going to war. And, of course, they are. And they may be killed if they don't go to war. But, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, in many cases, people voluntarily go to war and do so enthusiastically. Even though the chances of their survival may be very low. So, I mean, you know, the people were throwing themselves into battle in ways which are hard to explain, other than in terms of doing something for the good of the whole. Anyway, so, I mean, we were all given this challenge, I mean, right at the, when we came to this meeting. To what extent can one account for group behaviour in terms of the properties of its constituent units as exhibited when they're isolated, and to what extent does one need to invoke group-level emergent traits? I mean, that was our challenge. And I mean, rather disappointing, I'm afraid, my answer is, to some extent. So, thank you very much.
I think this is going to lead to a great deal of debate, so we need to organize some more energy. No, please wait.
Just to come to your point about individuals actively participating in the evolution of their descendants.
Yes.
So couldn't that those properties also be under natural selection? Because I think you meant to imply that that somehow is not part of natural selection.
No, so I didn't say that at all. No, what I said was that the metaphor of natural selection tends to suppose that the process has a passive organism. My point was that they're actually organisms not passive. They do lots which affect their descendants through the process of natural selection. I mean, I didn't want to throw out the idea, the Darwinian idea of, you know, variation, difference of survival and transmission, but just to say that there has been an unfortunate consequence, which you see in some of the if you go to some of the evolutionary textbooks, there's a strong implication that the only thing that matters in evolution is changes in gene frequency. And I would contest that. I think that, you know, there's all sorts of reasons to think that if you look at actually what happens, what animals and plants do is very important in that Darwinian process.
So I was wondering about strategies which insulate against cheating in reciprocal altruism. In the monkey group, a tit-for-tat strategy would probably insulate against it. But would we actually figure out which is the best possible strategy to insulate against cheating in a reciprocal altruism?
In a situation of reciprocal altruism,
yes.
If one of the two parties doesn't pay back, what would be the best strategy to ensure against that happening?
Well, obviously one strategy would be punishment. Another would be actually the breakup of that relation. I mean, these where they've been observed, and there's good empirical evidence for cyclical altruism, where you get these cases. These individuals know each other very well. They're part of the same group. They may even be related, but they don't have to be related. So if one party did not reciprocate, that would be the end of that relationship. The thought is that reciprocal altruism is maintained by the favour being returned. And if it's not returned, end of that relationship.
You said that the gene as a unit of selection is not a very interesting unit, and that you would be happy to discuss about this. I completely agree with you, but I'm working in the Department of Molecular Biology, and I noticed that most of my colleagues consider as the Dawkins selfish gene as something okay, and even as the basic paradigm for their research. And so I have my argument against it, but I would like for you to expose why you think that it's a bad unit of selection.
Well, Richard Dawkins and I are old friends, but we've had a long-standing argument about this. I've said that Richard's argument really relies on a form of teleology, that by investing genes with intentions, it helps people to deal with a very complicated process of evolution. Just as, to give you a completely sort of neutral case, if you think about weather forecasting, how often do you hear weather forecasters say this depression is trying to move in? They're using teleological language to describe a complicated process. And in fact, there was a very famous dynamicist, a physicist working in the 19th century called Hamilton, another Hamilton, who actually explicitly used teleological principles to explain complex dynamics, because he said it's a heuristic. It helps us to understand a complicated process. So my feeling about the selfish gene was a heuristic. It helped people to understand complicated processes, but it didn't follow from that therefore we should use the gene as being the unit of selection. In a way, what Steve Gould criticized Richard for saying was, Richard is using just a form of accountancy to describe evolution. It doesn't actually help us to understand the process. So, I think people read Richard's books, and he writes beautifully, and it's very easy for us to go away with, I think, the wrong message, in fact. And I said, okay, Richard, you use your teleology to apply to the gene. And I said, well, what about the nest? The nest, you could say, we could talk about the selfish nest. Interestingly, it was kind of partly a joke, but it made a serious point, namely that there are a whole constellation of things which ensure transmission from one generation to the next. Richard's response to me was to say, but NEST doesn't have any genes. there's an interesting issue of how you relate the kind of gene selection argument to the population selection argument. And Richard said, it's just different ways of describing the same thing. It's not true, because the notion of a selfish gene implies an absolute. Whereas the population statistics, when they're talking about genes, are talking about differences. And you can't talk about a difference being an absolute. You can imagine when something goes to fixation, then the basis for talking about difference disappears. And so, it's not like the Necker cube. It's not like something, the same body of evidence being viewed from different angles. Different bodies of evidence are being treated in different ways, for quite different reasons too, and when we're dealing with great complexity, and we need ways of thinking about complexity, but we shouldn't confuse our heuristic with reality.
May I intervene here, just to ask Pat, how would you look at meiotic drive?
How would I look at meiotic drive? Pass. doesn't explain what the problem, what the question is.
No, it exists as a phenomenon.
That's yeah, I know. But,
so now the question is there, even without using the word adaptation, could you say that selection is acting at the level of the gene?
No. No, I don't think it helps.
And why not?
Because it's not talking about an adaptation in the sense.
No, I don't want to use the word adaptation.
Well, I did. I mean, because it seemed to me this was the crucial distinction. I mean, you could apply adaptation to organisms. I don't think you can readily apply it to genes or even to the products of mitotic drive. I don't think it can be regarded as an adaptation.
As I said, without using the word, if the phenomenon exists, then clearly something is changing in the course of time.
Yes.
And that change is occurring at the level of the gene, to the detriment of the individual.
Sure. And one, I think one was left saying, well, yes, sure, there'll be mechanisms which do funny things. I mean, cells divide, sometimes to generate cancers. I mean, that's not to the benefit of the individual. It's property of cells, which they can sometimes do that. Property of mitosis that you sometimes can get mitotic drive. But I don't think that follows from that this is an adaptation in the obvious sense.
Sylvia, something? Am I right? Yeah. Someone did, Just wait for the mic.
Thank you. It was about your last question. I don't know if you can let it reappear on the screen, on the projection.
I'll put it up again. If I can make my computers are open. Apple make these things so very difficult to get them once again.
Okay, well, I have a little problem with the idea of looking at constituent units in isolation, in the sense that I have the feeling that sometimes it is very hard to observe something isolated from the rest of the unit or group or whatever. And I think that there is also something that is missing in your sentence, that you also need to know the relation between the constituent units to know the emergent property and not just what are the properties of the unit in isolation.
Well, shall I first say, it wasn't my sentence. It was Ilya's. this was the challenge we were given. And this is the challenge I tried to answer. Because I was saying that, you can have within an organism things which it does perfectly well in the interest of itself. And I think actually that was really the point that Eleanor was making in her talk. But you could also have that same organism then combining with other organisms to do things where the adaptation is not at the level of a single individual, but at the level of multiple individuals, which then can't be subverted by a gene. So I mean, I think that was the point. I mean, Lydia, you may want to rephrase your challenge.
Yeah, I'll think over it. Mike. Would you get the mic here? Yeah, I'll come to you over.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I'm
Mike Hill.
I'm from
Canada.
I'm
going to
my point was the different units of selection. Why should they be mutually exclusive? I can't one imagine that selection is operating in four different levels.
Well, one can. I think one can. I mean, I think that it was not that the selection couldn't operate at any different levels, but the question was at what level is the adaptation occurring?
And then, roughly, natural selection acting, also adaptation working at different levels.
Sorry?
Even adaptation, working at different levels, why should they be mutually exclusive?
I mean, my point was it doesn't have to be at one level. I mean, you can have adaptation taking at one level, which doesn't preclude the possibility of adaptation taking at another level. And so in answer to the challenge which we were given, I'm saying sometimes you will get individuals cooperating in a way which is then allows for adaptation to operate at a higher level of organization. That was, I think, the issue. That, to a certain extent, we can say to in response to Vidya, sometimes it can happen. It doesn't mean to say that it happens a lot, but it can be, particularly in more complicated animals, it can happen.
Well,
I just wanted to comment on your slide of the hand of natural selection.
Yes.
You only show two individuals, and apparently natural selection would operate on an organism which from the previous talk can be considered like a group of individuals.
Yeah, sure.
Which I don't understand is that are there many events of natural selection which fail if they operate only on an individual? In the previous one, when it comes down, both the rabbits are under the hand, but it picks up one.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I mean, this is just meant to be a kind of a visual image to make the point that there's an implicit idea of an agent then selecting a particular type. I mean, there could be lots of black rabbits, obviously. And if lots and lots of black rabbits are selected, then they're more likely to replace the lighter rabbits in a black environment. And this comes back to the nature of the environment, of course. You know, it wouldn't work if the environment wasn't quite so dark. If it was lighter, then sort of the lighter rabbit might be at an advantage. No, I mean, this wasn't meant to make a serious scientific point. It was made to make a kind of point about how we tend to treat this hand of selection as a kind of having a kind of personality.
The point would be that would it fail at times to select? If it was acting only on an individual, would it fail in selecting?
No, I didn't want to make that point. I mean, I simply wanted to make the point that under certain conditions, like a very dark environment, a dark animal would be favoured over a light animal. But if it was going to work in evolutionary terms, it'd have to be on a population basis.
Yes, that's what I mean.
I completely agree. I mean, I wasn't trying to make a serious scientific point about this. Merely a point about how we use language, you know, and we tend to kind of personify
the process. Connected to the previous talk, where an individual is different than an organism.
I think that there is general agreement that genes code for proteins, not for phenotypes.
Sure.
But why people have extrapolated out of this thing that nobody, let's say, challenges?
I think it's a very interesting issue, actually. My sense is that many of my colleagues have been brought up in a kind of world where they think in terms of causal chains. I mean, that's one thing leads to another, which leads to another. And in a way, that kind of thinking was necessary to do kind of analytical science. You had to think about a small constellation of causes, even in one cause. So from there, you get this kind of curious thought that the gene is the same as the organism. And you know, I think for all sorts of developmental reasons, this is completely misleading.
Could I add something?
Yeah, please.
Could you ascribe a value to the sociological meaning of this change, this misunderstanding?
I think that it actually lies at the heart of this whole meeting, in fact. I mean, that people are moving much more now towards systems thinking. And some of my most distinguished molecular biology friends feel that in a way that the whole movement in molecular biology is kind of bottomed out, and that what they now need to think about is how genes interact with each other to generate complexes of proteins, which would then generate the kind of phenotype which we see in an intact organism. And so people are now kind of moving away from sort of just relentless reductionism to a much more holistic approach. And I mean, Lydia will remember when we had a meeting in Sikkim that the title of my paper for that symposium was The Return of the Whole Organism.
Bravo.
Yeah, I just wanted to maybe throw a spanner in the works a little bit. So one of the things that I want to talk about in my next talk is how you can show some evidence for something at a group level, for in that particular case learning, that you cannot show at an individual level. Now, this has been shown in Western civilizations. Now, people found something very similar in terms of parental caring styles where, you know, you take care of the infant, you teach them in some way and so forth, in some South African tribe. Now here's the thing, that right nearby, not too far away, is another tribe which in, for all practical purposes, is very similar, but they absolutely have a completely different way of parental care, where they do not have explicit teaching,
yeah.
They leave the children to themselves, children go out and die in the wild and so forth. So it seems to be that there has to be an interaction between group level selection and in some sense the environment, and that this prediction of whether or not it would be at the group level or individual level, would, there might be a larger environmental influence.
I completely agree. I think there's also a sociological phenomenon, or I mean an anthropological phenomenon, which is that people will do an awful lot for people that are other people who are a member of their own social group. And they will hate people who come from another social group. And we're all aware of the kind of the racism which can be generated simply by the basis of people being different from yourself. And it can be argued, and it has been argued quite strongly, that this in-group, out-group characteristic of human beings may have driven a lot of the kind of cooperative behavior we see now, that you do an enormous amount for your own group, and another group which you're competing with loses out as a result of that. And so that then drives the process of cooperation and group activity. It's very hard, I think, to explain otherwise what's going on, because, I mean, you know, humans are amazingly willing to do things to their own disadvantage. And you know, Darwin was aware of that, and I think many people are aware of it now. And just kind of clutching at one explanation in terms of Hamilton's rule seems to be... I think it's damaging, actually, to further thought.
Can I interject something in relation to what you said just now? You made a comment when you referred to the latest Krebs and Davis book,
yes.
And where they referred to the new group selection,
yeah.
Business, and said it's the same as Hamilton's rule in some sense.
Yeah.
You made the comment that they ignored the fact that you get recombination. Did you mean epistasis or recombination?
I meant epistasis. And also other forms of interaction with the environment. In other words, putting back the organism into its whole context, not only in terms of development, but also in terms of its ecology, all of these things kind of matter to what you get.
Thanks. Buddy?
Is it safe to say that selection takes place at the phenotypic level or behavior level, whether it's an individual or a group, and genes basically provide the necessary underlying basis,
sure.
For both. And what Vidya was pointing out, the meiotic drive, and meiotic drive, if I bring it into the picture, provides us the necessary variation or the flux or dynamics in order to develop necessary phenotype.
Yeah, I mean, I think my point was that there are a lot of these kind of phenomena which are obviously very important for biologists to understand. And the question is, does that provide us with a good concept for dealing with the notion of adaptation? And I mean, it may be argued that in cancer, those cells can develop a kind of immortality. I mean, I've just been reading this wonderful book about the immortal cells of Henrietta Lacks, where this was a woman who had cancer, and they took some tissue samples. It turned out that the cells they took were able to reproduce in tissue culture, so that they're now being used all over the world for all sorts of different kinds of experiments. And so this one woman who died more than half a century ago, her cells now kind of, if you gather them all together, would sort of cover the whole world. I mean, billions and billions of these cells which would be reproduced. So in that sense, these cells were kind of adapted, if you like, to the environment of tissue culture, and where they could actually be reproduced again and again and again, effectively immortally. I mean, very very interesting case. Well, those of us have read the book. Kind of very, it's a very readable book, actually, so it's well worth looking at. But I mean, my point is simply that if you get the case like that, then you need to look at the analysis in terms of what was the source of variation? In this case, it seemed to be to do with the cells being able to divide continuously because they could rebuild the mechanisms for mitotic division. And so they didn't suffer the fate of most cells in tissue culture. Then there was a question of differential survival. And if they'd been thrown away, of course, they wouldn't have survived. When cancer invades the body and the body dies, the cells don't survive either. So there's that issue. And then there's a question of transmission from one generation to the next. So it depends on the case you're taking. And some of these cases could perhaps be put in terms of adaptation at a different level of organization. And I wouldn't want to conclude from that, though, that it's very helpful to talk about genes having an adaptation, because the genes are always interacting with everything else, and so they're producing something at a higher level of organization. So it's a question really of how we think about these things, the kind of concepts which we apply to them. I think that what Ellen was saying before me was actually very important, a way of thinking about how these things come together, and you get sort of effectively individuation. So I don't know whether that answers your question, but I think it's a very important issue to get our thinking straight about.
What's the frequency of one-way reciprocal altruism?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
What is the frequency of one-way reciprocity? What would that mean?
I mean, there would be some individuals who would keep helping others without even being...
Oh, I see. You mean, to what extent are individuals being purely selfish?
Yeah.
Often. I mean, clearly, you get many examples of selfish behavior. And it may well be in the interest of the individual to behave selfishly. But as we've seen, there are mechanisms for punishing selfish behavior. And so it's not quite as common as it might otherwise be. If we didn't have methods of punishment, we would have more selfishness.
This is a comment to come back to the level of the gene selection. Actually, if you look at the definition of gene that Dawkins provides in his 86 book, it's very interesting because in the beginning he's speaking this metaphor and teleologic model.
Yes.
It is interesting to forget about the metaphoric part, which was half. Was really stimulating many disputes and so on. You just take the message, the built-in message that selection could occur at the gene level. But then he has a definition, a problem. And the problem is how to define a gene. And he says, you should be aware that what I define gene here is not a cistron. It is not even an operon, or it has not even to be on the same strand of DNA. He says, what I define gene is a set of loci that may interact together and be selectable. And so there is a circularity in the book itself, because
yeah.
The claim of the book is that the level of selection is the gene, but he places such a difficulty in defining gene that finally he ends up defining gene as the selectable unit. And so there is no message.
I think we can easily criticize that particular argument. And I have.
Can we go back to that challenging
statement? Which one?
The challenge.
Oh, the challenge. Do I need to put up?
Well, the question I have with you is, I have several analogs in mind, about one and the many, including polynomials and many body problems and so on. And up to some number, problems are solvable. Beyond that number, they become insoluble. So I was wondering whether in the definition of a group there's a criticality involved as far as the number is concerned, or whether there's an assumption implicit here that number is always more than critical. And if number is always more than critical, then most critical systems predicate emergent phenomena which will not be derivable from the behavior of the individual units. And in that sense, could biology predicate something very different?
Is that addressed to me?
I think it was you. He was looking at you, not to me.
I thought that was just to threaten me and because okay, the question is the following. This business of individuals and groups, does number play an important role? Is there a critical number below which you don't need to bother yourself too much, if I might summarize what you said, and beyond which you really get into a new regime? And well, my answer to that would be, it depends. I can't say yes or no, you know, across the board. The spirit behind the question was, are there cases in which 1 plus 1 is no longer 2, but sometimes greater than 2, sometimes less than 2? And if so, how do we go about explaining it?
Yeah. And after all, I mean, you know, you go to chemistry, so, you know, hydrogen and oxygen, obviously different from water. And so, in fact, they're very good chemists who talk explicitly about emergent properties in chemistry, which I think actually are rather helpful.
Well, I suppose a really fine discussion. Thanks very much.